CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Dana Innanen will be telling us a little bit about the London Cannonballs. So, can you tell me a little bit about the London Cannonballs?
Certainly. So, the London Cannonballs, we were founded in 1989 by a previous Paralympic athlete by the name of Debbie Willows. So, we've been around since 89. Bocce is a sport that can be played by any type of athlete that has a disability. So we have athletes that can either throw or they use the assistance of a ramp. We even have some athletes that will kick the ball towards the jack ball, which is the object of the sport. So there's a jack ball, which is a white ball. Each athlete will have six balls, and you try to get your ball as close to the jack as possible. The London Cannonballs, we practice on Wednesday nights at Stronach Community Centre from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. We are always looking for new athletes and people wanting to come in and give the sport a try. Currently, we do have two previous Paralympic athletes, Adam Dukovic and Tammy McLeod, that do come out to our practices and help out with both the club and the athletes.
So, how do you go about reaching out to potential athletes to let them know that your club exists and this might be a good sport for them?
So we are in the process of kind of doing a social media campaign, trying to get out new athletes. We send out flyers. We are looking at possibly hosting a couple open houses or fun days, as we would like to call them, for Bocce, where people can come out, see what the sport's about, and just give it a try. We also do have a website, and we also do belong to our governing body is called Bocce Canada, and they have a website, so they do a lot of advertising, and we're listed under one of the local clubs that's in the Ontario area. London, we usually have one of the bigger clubs. Is in Ontario is usually the London Cannonballs itself.
So, What are some of the benefits for an athlete with a disability being able to participate in sport and keeping an active lifestyle through bocce?
Very good question. Some of the benefits is obviously the social aspect. You get to come out, get to see, you know, you get to build friendships, you get to have that kind of competitive edge between you and your friends that, you know, sometimes can get a little high, but it's always great to see the athletes, you know, just be able to get out and be around their friends and make friendships. And you get to travel all over these tournaments, all over Canada sometimes. So, you know, it's a sport that, you know, you can also travel with if you so choose.
So it looks like Adam's joined us on the line here. I was just asking Dana here about some of the benefits of playing bocce for an athlete with a disability. Do you want to chime in on this as well? Or?
So, a lot of the other benefits is, you know, obviously the social benefit, but also the physical benefits. Because no matter your level of physical limitation, you can still do bocce. Even if you start in bocce as a thrower, and then, you know, your body over time does deteriorate, or you're not able to throw, there is still, you know, you can always become a ramper. You know, there is some athletes that, you know, use their feet and kick the balls. So it's really a sport that anyone can play.
So, in your time with the club, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Oh, there's so many success moments. You know, we have an annual tournament called Bocce Blast that the London Cannonballs host. It's usually in September. So we usually have anywhere from 20 to 30 athletes come to that. We just currently hosted the Canadian Bocce Championships. So that is when each province sends their bocce team and they compete. So most of the success moments I've experienced is even when some of our athletes have just started off as rec athletes, you know, wanting to come out and just hang out and play with a bunch of cool people and have a fun time. And then, you know, they do decide to try and become competitive with it, and just to see those athletes grow.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why this is an important sport in the disabilities world and some of the benefits that someone might enjoy, maybe someone who's hesitating to get out there and give it a shot. Do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, certainly. You know, or, you know, try and find your local bocce club. You know, if London is close to you, you know, we do practice on Wednesday nights. You can always come out and see what it's about. And even if you don't want to, you know, quite participate the first time out, just come out and see what it's about. Bocce, we also host, as I said previously, Bocce Blast, which is a large tournament, which actually, as Adam just pointed out, is the oldest bocce event in Canada. There is no other tournament that has been going on as long as Bocce Blast has been. So you can always come out for that tournament and see various levels of athletes at it and see what the sport's really about.
So, is there any modified equipment other than the ramps that you use to make the sport accommodating?
So, it's mostly the ramps that is the adaptive equipment we use. Some athletes that do kick the ball will have a special pole that is strapped onto the front of their running shoe so that it can surround the ball a bit easier. But other than that, that it's really, those are really the only two adapter pieces of equipment that we would use.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. This next segment of our show, Johnny Rosa will be telling us a little bit about ARCI. Can you tell me a little bit about ARCI?
So the Amyloidosis Research Consortium, also known as ARC, is a nonprofit that's focused on accelerating drug development and improving outcomes for patients with all types of amyloidosis.
So, how do these conditions typically affect a person?
So, systemic amyloidosis is a group of rare diseases that affect multiple organs. So, there's an abnormal protein that's produced that misfolds and deposits in organs. And depending on the type of amyloidosis, it will depend on the pattern of deposition. And ultimately what happens is the patient will experience symptoms of a failing organ. So if it's in their heart, they'll get cardiac symptoms. Likewise, if it goes into their liver or kidneys, they can get symptoms that are typical of those organs starting to fail. It can also affect the autonomic nervous system and the GI system. So you'll hear about patients who will, when they stand up, will faint. As their blood pressure is out of balance, and also have really crippling and chronic symptoms of GI disturbances.
So when you mentioned that you advocate for better drug options, can you tell me a little bit about some of the specific ways you're pushing for better treatments?
Yes, absolutely. In 2012, the first drug was in development for amyloidosis, and it failed to get approval. It has actually subsequently been approved in 40 countries outside the US. And it was both safe and effective, but developing trials in rare diseases is really difficult, particularly when you don't know what to measure. And as we'd never seen a treatment or a benefit effect, we really didn't know what that should look like. So we work very hard. We've developed a public-private partnership with FDA, and we work with other regulatory agencies to really look at ways to design trials that will be effective and to test new treatments more rapidly. So it's a benefit to everybody in the field, and it also speeds the time for drugs to get developed and increases the number of organizations and companies that are interested then in coming into this rare disease space. Makes it more cost effective.
So, given the range of symptoms you described, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Misdiagnosis is a huge problem. And it's also a disease that often can, you know, it presents in ways that are not, there isn't a standard presentation. And the ways that it presents often mimic other rare diseases, or not rare diseases, but more common diseases. And so we typically, on the patient journey to diagnosis, we see that patients have often been diagnosed with a different disease, have seen multiple physicians, often as many as, you know, 4 to 6 physicians before they get an accurate diagnosis. And we believe a lot of patients aren't diagnosed. But it's really a hugely underdiagnosed set of diseases.
But given being treated for something else, isn't there a risk of exacerbating the symptoms of these conditions if they're not targeting the correct thing?
Yes, and actually for one of the types of amyloidosis, wild type it's called, which predominantly affects the heart, some of the standard treatments, which for heart failure, which is the symptom that patients experience, actually the beta blockers can cause more harm than good. And that could actually be an indication, if you see a patient doing worse that on these drugs, that's something that should be considered.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by these diseases?
Oh, that's a great question. We actually don't, you know, estimates are changing. We think for AL amyloidosis, about 3 to 4,000 patients are diagnosed, new patients are diagnosed a year. Hereditary ATTR affects about, we know that it's in about 4% of African Americans carry this abnormal gene, but we still don't know what the prevalence is, so how many people will actually go on to develop the disease. And wild type, which affects an aging population, was considered very rare, and in recent years, as drugs have become developed, we're seeing it being diagnosed more and more frequently. And the questions are now is whether it is actually a rare disease or whether it's not. It's just still being underdiagnosed.
So, in your time with the consortium, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yes, I think when we look at the fact there are about 7,000 rare diseases and very few, 5% have treatments, we have seen since the formation of ARC, of the consortium, that we now have 5 drugs approved and we have more that are coming up for review. So the natural history of this disease, particularly when we look at the 2 ATTR types of amyloidosis, has gone from being a progressive fatal disease to a treatable condition.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in research and advocacy, what would you say?
So there are a couple of really important things. That these diseases are progressive. Treatments currently stop progression or slow progression, but people are having to live with the damage that's already there. So early diagnosis is vital. Awareness in the general medical community is key to getting patients diagnosed accurately and swiftly. And additionally, we're very fortunate to have treatments. There's still a huge unmet need in this and these diseases, and we need more and better treatments so that all patients can live after their diagnosis and live really a full and good quality life.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or addiction, consider registering to the new REACT program launched by Downtown Windsor Community Collaborative. REACT is a 90-day program committed to understanding your story and supporting your journey to healthy and long-term healing. All sessions are online and completely free, running weekdays from 9 a.m. until noon. Visit reactwindsor.ca and instantly be connected to a safe and supportive community. That's reactwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Dana Inanen told us a little bit about the London Cannonballs, and we heard about ARCI from Johnny Rosa. In this segment of our show, Scott McGrew will be telling us about HRSA. So, can you tell me a little bit about the Hansen's Disease Program?
So, the Hansen's Disease Program is a national program funded by the federal government of the United States that deals with people that have leprosy. So the Hansen's Disease Program was started in 1921 and has been working with caring and curing cancer, excuse me, not cancer, but leprosy ever since that time.
So how do you go about reaching out to those affected?
How do I go about reaching out to those who are affected? You mean us as a group?
Yes.
So usually what happens is patients are diagnosed by a private physician, and then they will be referred to the National Hansen's Disease Program from there. We have a referral system across the United States where we have 10 to 12 ambulatory care clinics so that patients can be treated regionally, hopefully within half a day's drive of their home, and can receive the care that they need.
So what are some of the most common impacts of Hansen's disease?
That's a great question. So there are quite a few different symptoms that go along with Hansen's disease. This is really what we would say a disease that you can wear. So a disease that affects the skin, the eyes, and the nerves of the distal extremities. So you can have some real severe lesions on the skin. It can cause blindness because of corneal insensitivity, and so people don't blink as much as they need to in order to keep their eyes moist, and that causes scarring and then blindness. It also affects the distal extremities, your fingers and your toes, hands and feet, and causes insensitivity and loss of muscle strength in the hands and feet. And so that can lead to real severe injuries with thermal burns, with just broken bones that you don't even know are occurring, and it can end up with amputations. So there's a wide variety of symptoms. Probably the most severe problem is that patients begin to develop a lack of independence and autonomy. They can't button their pants. They can't zip a zipper, and it just becomes very challenging to care for themselves.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected with this disease?
Yes. So, in 1980, there were 4 million new cases a year worldwide. And now, in 2023, we have that number down to about 200,000 people diagnosed each year worldwide. In the United States, we have about 200 new cases a year. 70% of those cases are folks that have immigrated to the United States, and about 30% of the cases are what we call autochthonous cases. They have contracted the disease within the boundaries of the United States.
So, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions concerning Hansen's or leprosy as a whole?
In the Bible and in several different religious texts, it talks about leprosy being a curse, a punishment. And leprosy is actually just a bacterial disease that we can cure with antibiotics. And so there's a lot of fear that surrounds the idea of leprosy. And so oftentimes people are mistreated when they are discovered to have leprosy by their communities, by their families and friends. And it can be pretty severe for folks. So there's a significant stigma that goes along with leprosy and is very difficult for patients to deal with. And so a common myth that people would say is, if I touch somebody, I can get leprosy. And that's just not the case. You can sit down and have lunch with someone. You could sit next to them on the bus. You can shake their hands. You can give them a hug. Those things are not going to give you leprosy. Oftentimes, even healthcare providers are unsure about the symptoms of leprosy. We have a patient that just made an appointment to be seen at the dentist, and the dentist, when he realized he had leprosy, they sent us a letter saying they needed to have clearance in order to see that patient. That patient had not had leprosy for 10 years. He was cured. But people are unsure about the disease, and there's, again, a lot of fear that surrounds it.
So
go ahead.
In your time working with the program, has there been any success that you've seen, maybe where you've been able to clear up some of these misconceptions?
Yes. So whenever those things arise, advice. We send out literature and information to doctors. We offer online trainings where we'll do a webinar with physicians at a given hospital, and we're able to help them identify what's true and what's not true about leprosy and recognize symptoms of leprosy and then how to treat it effectively. And we also talk to families. We see a lot of success in helping people through education. That's one of the big keys about anything, really, that is scary and unknown. We have to help people understand what it is and what the truth is about, in this case, leprosy.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks.
I'd love to.
Thank you. My friends, I find it fascinating that we still live in our modern world under some of the myths or precepts about certain conditions. Take leprosy, for example. Yes, in times past, it would have been something that would have been a major source of a problem. But it is not a curse. It is a virus. It is not a reason to declare a person evil or unfit to be a part of society. The truth is, myths like that only die out if we as a people have the courage to challenge them. But it's not just things like that. There's things like disabilities and academics. The idea that those who get accommodations are getting an unfair advantage. It's not true. It's about leveling the playing field, giving an equal opportunity. And that those who collect any sort of government assistance are lazy and don't want to work, completely the opposite. A lot of them do want to be a part of the community and contribute to their fullest. They would if someone would simply be willing to bend or flex just a little bit to open the door for them. I say, we can do better as a people. I've always believed this, my friends. These myths and stereotypes concerning disabilities, they're getting better with time. I will acknowledge that. But that is simply because a few brave souls have the courage to stand up and say, I should be counted too. I am an equal part of this community. Don't assume I'm greater than or less than because of any one factor of who I am. But isn't that how progress is always made, my friends? The idea of someone saying, we can take a step forward. And from there, another step. Change does take time, and it does take courage. But I see so many people and so many organizations working together to bring forth that change. Even if they're not aware that they're working together, anyone who betters things for the disability community is an important part of the puzzle. And united, we are making a difference. It's a wave movement going forward. As with any group in society, there should always be equal consideration, not a sense of entitlement, but simply a chance to engage and contribute with one's community. And honestly, no one has the right to say your abilities aren't enough or your condition makes you undesirable. You don't know. That person with leprosy, for example, might be most interesting, charismatic person you'll ever hope to meet. They might not be. Depends upon the person. Everyone has a story to share, and everyone has gifts and talents to bring to this community. So I'm asking you, my friends, take a step towards keeping an open mind today. It doesn't have to be a huge thing. Just try to keep it in your head that a person with a disability is a person first. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.